This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. A recently released report offers details on some of the cases of post-9/11 torture in which North Carolina was directly involved. The torture was part of the CIA's Extraordinary Rendition Program, in which individuals suspected of anti-American terrorism were kidnapped and held at secret sites around the world. The North Carolina Commission of Inquiry on Torture released its report after an 18-month investigation. It identifies 49 people who were flown out by a North Carolina-based aviation company called Aero Contractors. Prisoners were then delivered to black sites where many received so-called enhanced interrogation approved by a post-9/11 administration. The report is called Torture Flights, North Carolina's Role in the CIA Rendition and Torture Program. And today we're joined by two experts who have a connection with the report. Joe Margulies is a professor of law and government at Cornell University and represents one of the detainees. Thanks for joining us, Joe.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
And Catherine Porterfield is a senior psychologist at Bellevue Hospital in New York, worked for the Bellevue NYU Program for Survivors of Torture for almost two decades and interviewed some of the detainees. Hello, Catherine.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
And we just want to note here that some of this content in this segment will be graphic and disturbing. Joe, the report cites 49 people in the CIA's torture program who were actually flown out of North Carolina. And among those transported by Aero Contractors was Abu Zubaydah, actually thought to be the first CIA detainee subjected to waterboarding. The report says he was waterboarded at least 83 times. Abu Zubaydah was your client. What else do you know about what happened to him in CIA custody?
Well, in fact, he's still my client. And he was subjected to the, in fact, he's the only guy who was subjected to the entire catalog of, quote, enhanced interrogations, as well as quite a number that were not authorized. In addition to the waterboard, which if we have the time, we should talk about what that really is. There's people chat about that as though it's simulated drowning or just dripping a few drops of water on a person's face. It's nothing of the sort. He was also kept awake for seven consecutive days and nights and suspended from hooks in the ceiling and doused with cold water to keep from falling asleep. He was crammed into boxes. One box was about the size of the space underneath a dining room chair. Another one was the size of a very narrow coffin. And then, of course, there are the environmental manipulations, the cold room, the loud music, the bombardment of cacophonous noise. It's all to achieve the same purpose, which is this sense of disorientation and debilitation that creates a sense of terror and such a disconnection from one's own reality that the belief is it makes you susceptible to interrogation. What in fact it does is makes you desperate to make the torture stop.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a minute, how ineffective it is, because you'll say whatever to make it stop, so you never know if you've got good information. But beyond that, who did they, and we'll talk about waterboarding in a minute too, because I do want to get some of the details here. This is inhumane treatment, to be sure, by any definition, inhumane. By international standards, it is illegal, and it was justified by executive authority. So all of this sort of has to be said. Who did they think they had? Because it turns out he wasn't the guy they thought he was. But tell us why they picked him up in the first place, Joe.
Well, the belief was, right after 9/11, the bane of American security existence was bad intelligence. We didn't know what we were confronting. And at the time, they believed that Abu Zubaydah was a senior al-Qaeda figure with close associations to Osama bin Laden, and that he had participated in the planning for all of al-Qaeda's operations, and that he had a particular expertise in resisting interrogations. And all of that combined to make it important for them to use not just conventional interrogation techniques, since he was adept at resisting those, but these sophisticated enhanced techniques, because that's the only way you could break him and establish what he knew. And, it turns out they were simply mistaken. And what they interpreted as nefarious obfuscation, that is, when he said he didn't know anymore, we need to ratchet it up, in fact was he didn't know the information that they were seeking because he wasn't the person they thought he was.
Talk more and tell us about waterboarding. Just what is it so we have a better idea?
Waterboarding is a person is strapped vigorously, that is ankles, legs, hips, waist, arms, wrists, shoulders, chest, head, to an inclined board. The board, your head is lower than your feet, and your neck is jutted so that your head is, the top of your head is below your mouth. And then something is wrapped around your face to obstruct your breathing, like a towel or plastic. And then water is poured up your nose and down your throat, and it forces you to breathe the water. And so, of course, as soon as you start to breathe the water, you begin to drown. And just when the body, the brain convinces the body that you are going to die, you are just at the moment that you are going to drown, the interrogators gauge when that second is. They see you straining against the straps and retching, and they raise you up. You vomit out the water and retch. And when you take one gasp of air, then they put you back down and do it again. And that process for Abu Zubaydah, according to the government, was repeated 83 times in the month of August 2002 alone. That's what waterboarding is. It is not simulated drowning. It is drowning. You are drowning. And the only thing that keeps you from drowning is the art of raising up the board to let you vomit out the water just before you die.
Well, let's talk about the impact of this. Dr. Catherine Porterfield, senior psychologist at Bellevue Hospital. What are the effects of torture in general from a psychological perspective?
Sure. Well, in general, when you think about a person being subjected to torture, you know, the definition of which is severe pain and suffering being enacted on the person that would cause physical or psychological terror and pain. What you're talking about is that the human body actually goes into a really an involuntary process that tries to react against this pain. So you get into a whole cascade of neurophysiological responses in the body that try to keep you alive, right? So it's, we think about fight, flight, freeze as these reactions. So when you torture someone, you enact that kind of process in their on their body. So they go into that neurophysiological protection mode. And then afterwards, the problem is those systems, if they've been activated long enough, hard enough, and, you know, for multiple times, those systems are then dysregulated. So the person then goes back into that fear reaction, that arousal reaction, again, involuntarily, even after the torture has happened. So you see people with symptoms of what we call hyperarousal, you know, being on edge, sleep problems, irritability. They have numbness where their body tries to shut down the feelings and the reactions. They have what we call re-experiencing, where the memory of the torture comes back, and it's not a memory, it's that they are actually reliving it in the form of fear reaction in their body again. So that's sort of the broad picture of what happens to people who are tortured.
You talked with some of the survivors of the CIA program. Can you talk about some of the psychological impact that you saw with the detainees?
Yeah, so in my work, I've evaluated or consulted with numerous people and their teams, people who were subjected to these you know, techniques, which, by the way, the word technique itself is a euphemism, right? It's kind of taking away the meaning of the abuse that's happening to the person by calling it this sort of pseudoscientific term, right? Enhanced interrogation technique. So just as a caveat. And by the way, I have a, you know, classification issues on this topic because the United States government has classified parts of what happened to these people. And so those of us who have been exposed to the information, we also have to follow those classification rules. So nothing I'm going to say today would break those rules or would confirm or deny any classified information. But that said, I can speak broadly to the fact that, you know, everything I said earlier about that sort of neurophysiological fear reaction being, you know, then sort of wired into the person, I've seen in these men. So problems with those arousal, sleep, irritability, fear reactions coming. But actually, what I would like to sort of draw as a different reaction is that I've seen something else in these men that is sort of different than what I see at my work at Bellevue, where we deal with folks coming out of war zones and prisons all around the world. And that is these sort of what I think of as a real psychic damage to them done by the severity of what the torture program was and the intentionality of it and the way they were so, for such extended periods of time, abused by such a powerful, powerful set of forces. And, you know, just last thing I'll say on that is that, you know, what it looked like when you meet with these men and speak with them was this real damage done to their sense of self, but also to their sense of other humans and what other humans are. And so you could evoke in a man very quickly a real fear reaction, as well as a sense that he was going to be harmed, even when you were doing nothing at all intentionally in that direction, you know, towards harming him.
But let me stay with that for just 1 minute, because I want to underscore something you said. You didn't start with these detainees. You've been doing this for a long time, and you've met with other people before these detainees who have come from some horrific situations in barbaric war zones where a lot of this kind of behavior has gone on as well, right? And this kind of treatment has been, and they've endured in other situations, in other wars, this barbaric treatment. And you're saying this is categorically different than what you've seen in those cases?
I think so. You know, at Bellevue, we see folks from all over the world. I mean, you know, I've worked with folks from Kosovo, Egypt, Colombia, you know, Democratic Republic of Congo, Haiti, you know, places where there is no shortage of, you know, violations of human rights that happen in wartime and in prisons. But what you saw, or what I saw in these situations that came out of the U.S. program, were the consequences were coming out of the experience of having the most powerful government in the world train all of its resources and all of its organizational capacity against you. So it's a very long reach, very deep coffers, many actors. And these men knew that. They felt the power of what was coming at them. And they also felt the fact that these actors would stop at nothing to harm them. And that they were really going to be destroyed. And I think many of these men knew that they were not simply being, quote unquote, interrogated for information. They were really being punished and dehumanized for what had happened on 9/11.
Yeah, and if that's the case, then that's, again, almost the definition of terrorism, right, where you take individuals and you put them through a horrific experience as an example to the rest of the population. That's the very definition of terrorism. So that's why we're talking about anti-American terrorism here versus the homegrown brand that we might be seeing elsewhere. Joe Margulies, let's talk about, as you said, they got the wrong guy. They thought he was somebody else, thought he had more power than, or more significance in the organization than he might have had. This gets to the lack of due process, the fact that all of this happens in secret, that you're grabbed, you're brought to various sites, including the site in Johnston County, where 49 of the detainees were flown out. You talk a little bit more from a legal standpoint about that. Does the United States have apparently the right to go into another country, kidnap somebody, and then fly them to another place? Where are we legally with that kind of behavior with no due process? So there's no scrutiny, no accountability about whether you had enough evidence to take this individual.
Right. That's right. Let me just correct one thing so that there's no confusion on the part of the listeners. None of these guys were ever held in North Carolina. The aero contractors operated out of North Carolina. It was a CIA shell company, and they flew two jets out of North Carolina that were used in the rendition program and picked up people, including Abu Zubaydah, at various locations around the world and flew them to black sites where they were tortured. And we know those black sites were in places like Bangkok, Thailand, and Poland, and Lithuania, and Romania, and Morocco, et cetera. But none of these guys were ever held on the U.S. mainland. Some of them now are at Guantanamo, and Abu Zubaydah is at Guantanamo now. And that's where Catherine has interviewed folks. But just to be clear what North Carolina's connection was. You ask whether the United States has a right to do this. And what this really reveals is the impotence of the law. No, they don't have a right, but what they have is the power to resist the legal claims by others who would assert their rights. So long as the courts are prepared to resist claims by people who were tortured, who were in the CIA program, and to shield themselves behind legal fictions like the state secrets doctrine, even though everyone, the existence of the program has been widely acknowledged, the fact that Catherine and I can come on here and talk about it is only because there is a great deal that's already in the public record. The government insists that it's all still a state secret and that bars litigation about it. And as long as the courts are prepared to accept that, and as long as there is no meaningful other process by which you might achieve transparency or accountability through some legislative process, for instance, then they get away with it, not because they have a legal right, but because they can.
Let's talk a little bit about what's at stake here, because the argument is, look, this is a very different kind of warfare, a very different kind of world. This is an existential threat to the United States of America. We have to do something else, something different to meet this kind of a threat.
Yeah. You know, that's such a straw man. You hear it now and again. It was never true. It's certainly not true now. The fact is, this is not our first exposure to transnational terrorism or transnational Islamic terrorism. 9/11 wasn't the first. It wasn't the last. We had an extensive system of expertise that had been developed by which we would identify these people, bring them to justice in a court of law, using established rules. We have federal prisons that are chock full of prisoners who've been convicted in regular civilian courts of very serious offenses, and justice is served. There was no justice. We have experts in the FBI who know how to conduct these interrogations and know how to get this information without using unlawful and coercive techniques. I can see how people might have lost their head, but there's no justification for them still to have lost their head with all the information we now know about how poorly it was done. This idea that because 9/11 changed something means we have to throw out the whole playbook was stupid then. It is morally and legally bankrupt now.
Catherine, let me ask you this. You testified during the public hearings over this and as part of the this report that we're talking about today. Talk about the importance of this information being public.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I'm a psychologist, but I'm not a lawyer, so my purview is not as much the what can be done about this and the remedies. Of course, they're interesting to me, but what I'm interested in is human functioning, right? And so when I work with people who've been subject to human cruelty, and you see the pervasive, long-lasting, and serious effects of that, it's so troubling, right, as a mental health professional, because you think this is what humans do to each other. And we know darn well it's not only that it does harm, but then that harm is long-lasting and perpetuated in other ways. And so for me, the idea that this story will continue to be told is important, because we really need people to recognize why, when we lower ourselves to become abusers of humans, of other people, we harm those people terribly, but we also harm ourselves, and we create the groundwork for it just to go on and on. And it's very, very troubling to see that. So to me, any time this story is brought to light and people can hear about it and talk about it, it's a good thing for the survivors and for humankind.
Joe, I've only left you 30 seconds, but is there any form of reconciliation or recompense that is sensible in this case?
You know, it's interesting. Here, I can't tell you much about what my client says because it's not cleared for release. But what he wants is what I want, which is for the truth to be known. Not money, not lawsuits. He put everything on the table, everything. And that will be the reconciliation that the United States deserves.
Joe Margulies is a professor of law and government at Cornell University. Dr. Catherine Porterfield, a senior psychologist for Bellevue NYU Program for Survivors of Torture. Thank you both for being on our program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For more information on North Carolina's role in the CIA torture program, you can find a link to the full report at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we've got some live music. Ellis Dyson and the Shambles are with us. Stay tuned.